Some secrets can turn women into killers.
There was almost a darkness about her.
A mother conceals her crimes for decades in her ruthless pursuit of profit. Another has a secret so scandalous, she'll murder to keep it hidden.
She certainly excelled at the skill of deception.
And a nurse, entrusted with caring for a hospital's most vulnerable patients, gets away with murder.
We're not sure of exactly how many children she killed.
These are deadly women with dark secrets. June 25th, 1983, Pensacola, Florida. John Gentry shares an intimate dinner with his fiancée, Judy Buenoano. She has thrilling news.
I'm pregnant.
After all this time. Honey, I can't believe it.
Their future together seems assured. I can't believe that. Oh. Until later that night, when John leaves the house.
He left, went outside, it was dark. Started the car, turned the lights on. Car blew up.
That night would give Florida State Attorney Russell Edgar one of his most intriguing cases.
To blow up a car with dynamite in downtown Pensacola does get our attention. And it will cause us to work very hard to find out why this happened, who did it, and why they did it.
Miraculously, John Gentry survives the blast. But the discovery of dynamite residue in his car means this is no accident. Homicide Detective Ted Chamberlain is called in.
I've worked a lot of homicides, plenty of them, and this one here was probably the most complex case I've ever worked.
4 days later, Detective Chamberlain asks John Gentry one burning question. Who would profit from his death?
He said, well, really, I don't have any enemies. My mother, she would get so much if I died. And then my girlfriend and I, named Judy, we did have a policy together.
But John insists his loving fiance couldn't possibly be involved.
No. Can't believe that.
And he said, the policy's canceled, and don't worry about it. She wouldn't have nothing to do with it.
How about we get some champagne?
Champagne inspired.
As the investigation starts, speculation brews in Pensacola. Did Judy really try to kill John Gentry? Across town, local newscaster Sue Strawn realizes a breaking story involves a familiar face. She was a client at Judy Buenoano's nail salon.
I was getting my nails done and news came on and they were talking about the car, the explosion, and police investigating. And it was like the entire salon became deadly quiet. All chatter ceased. Nobody said anything. And Judy never stopped working on my nails. She never looked up, never stopped.
Little does anyone know just how much Judy is keeping to herself.
She was very quiet into herself. And there was almost a darkness about her. There was something, in retrospect, disquieting.
Crime writer Michael Kelleher would later document her trail of deceit.
Judy had told John that she was pregnant with his child. When in fact, she wasn't. She had been surgically sterilized more than 5 years before.
Oh, honey, I'm so happy.
In fact, the entire relationship was based on this incredible series of lies that she had woven.
Then even more lies come to light. State Attorney Russell Edgar discovers a disturbing piece of evidence.
And we obtained a policy of insurance that showed that Ms. Buenuano had taken out a policy of $500,000 on Mr. Gentry and therefore stood to gain from his death.
John thought that the policies Gentry, that they'd been canceled. And I told John, I said, no, son, they ain't been canceled.
Can't believe that.
Gentry was a little reluctant to believe it at first.
No.
She's got a $500,000 policy on you, $500,000. And that started him thinking.
John now realizes this may not be her first attempt to kill him.
It came out that she had been giving him vitamins that had been making him very sick.
Judy kept pushing John to take the vitamins.
Do I really need these?
Good for you.
Okay.
He said, and I'd take them and take them. He said, get sick, throw up. I went to the hospital. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me.
My stomach is aching.
He said, no, I'm not taking them. I didn't tell her. He said, I took two of the pills and put them in my briefcase.
It was later to be discovered that those weren't vitamins, but they were essentially poison pills.
Everything had been taken out of them, and paraformaldehyde had been put in them, and found that that's a class 3 poison.
I'm gonna need to go to the bathroom.
As investigators dig deeper, they find another shocking secret. Judy may have killed before.
I can't believe that.
In 1983, Florida businessman John Gentry thought he'd found his future wife.
How about we get some champagne?
Champagne inspired.
But from the night Judy Buenuano declared she was pregnant, things went downhill. His car has exploded. And he thinks Judy once tried to poison him with tainted vitamins. He's shocked to learn she has a secret life insurance on him worth $500,000. And now police tell John he may not be Judy's first victim. Judy may have killed before. 12 years earlier, Judy is married to James Goodyear.
He was an Air Force sergeant who had been in Vietnam for a year on a tour of duty.
James is home ready to enjoy some R&R with his new wife. But what he gets is arsenic poisoning.
Arsenic is a white powder. It has no taste. It dissolves easily. It has no odor. And so it can be easily put into food or drink.
And Judy is cunning enough to serve up tiny amounts that go unnoticed.
Well, thank you.
Long term, the arsenic deposits in the tissues and progressively damages both the liver and the heart. So many times, chronic arsenic poisoning is very difficult to detect.
Within 3 months, James Goodyear is dead. Judy collects a handsome insurance payment, and her murder remains a dark secret for more than a decade. According to criminal profiler Candace DeLong, this first murder set the stage for Judy Buenuano's career as a serial killer.
Frequently when we see women killing repeatedly, in serial type fashion, one of the motivators is money. They're killing for profit.
But more than a decade later, James Goodyear would speak from the grave when Detective Chamberlain's team exhumed his body.
There was enough arsenic still in him, like fingernails, the hair, to kill 12 people. So he was loaded. I mean, that boy was loaded with it when he went down.
Judy had gotten away with murder for 12 years, but she has an even darker secret involving her son, Michael.
When he turned 18, he wanted to join the military. And on his way to his posting in Georgia, he visited his mother.
Michael has no idea that Judy has taken out several insurance policies on his life.
Mom.
They're good for you.
It's believed that at that time, she fed him arsenic.
Judy is about to commit the unthinkable, to poison her own son.
Sociopaths don't feel love the way normal people do. A normal mother or father could never kill their child. To her, he was just another big check waiting to get into her bank account.
He didn't die. He went on to his next duty station. He became crippled. He became so crippled they had to discharge him from the military, and he wore braces on his arms and his legs because he was paralyzed from the elbow down and from the knees down.
Worse still, he's back in Judy's care.
He gets out of the hospital with all these braces on and everything else. She's got insurance policies on him.
Judy took Michael on a canoeing trip.
Mom, do we really need to be doing this?
He had 15 pounds of weighted braces on his arms and legs that enabled him to hold or grasp things.
Michael can barely walk, let alone swim.
She had apparently taken him up the river a couple of turns, out of sight of the landing and out of sight of public view.
No one can be sure why the canoe capsized.
One of her stories was they hit a log and overturned.
Wait! Help me!
Another story was that a snake fell in the boat.
Wait! Help me!
How long does it take to drown 15 pounds of weight strapped to you in the water?
Wait!
What must he have been thinking?
Bob! Wait! Help me!
Was my mother gonna come and save me? Was she, somebody, going to reach down and pick me up out of this water?
Any other parent, if your child had fallen into the deepest ocean, I think our first instinct, you're going after that child.
Wait.
But not Judy.
Help me! Help!
Sometime later, Judy hails a passing fisherman.
She said nothing about the son until she got to the shore and said her son was up river. She thinks he might have drowned, and then asked for a cold beer.
She collected military life insurance and two private life insurance policies on Michael.
She caused his disability that resulted in him needing these heavy metallic braces on his lower extremities that pulled him to the bottom of the lake, where he was unable to be saved. She did all of it. That's sadistic.
By the summer of 1983, police have pieced together Judy's secrets. Her latest extreme attempt to murder finally brings her undone.
She absolutely overreached with the car bomb. That was completely unnecessary. It was also outside her MO, outside her normal way of attacking her victims. But I think that boils down to wanting too much too soon.
Police would allege Judy murdered her son. She poisoned her first husband. And attempted to kill her fiancé, John Gentry.
She was a truly evil person, and that's the sense that I got when I was in the courtroom with her. It was a sense of evil. I nearly hadn't had that except a few times in my career, 30 years prosecuting.
A jury finds Judy Buenoano guilty of first-degree murder and first-degree grand theft. She is executed by electric chair in Florida on March 30th, 1998. Although Judy insisted to her grave she was innocent, those who knew her have no doubts about her guilt.
There's something. It wasn't right. I even have a hard time admitting that to you now. How do you put it? It wasn't right. It was just something that wasn't right.
Secrets are so shocking, people will kill to keep them. This murder has all the appearances of a straight crime of domestic violence. It is anything but.
When this story came to light, it took all the oxygen out of the media room. It consumed all the stories in the newspapers.
It was an extraordinary case. It was definitely the case of the decade.
Australian criminal history recorded one of its most unusual cases at the turn of the 20th century, after Scotsman Harry Crawford arrives in Sydney. Like many new arrivals, he takes work wherever he can get it. But life is tough. Harry is barely scraping by.
For 10 years, he ranged around Sydney. He worked in meatworks, he worked in pubs, always fairly rough outside work.
Author Suzanne Faulkner has researched one of Australia's most scandalous murders.
I think if people got suspicious or things got difficult or people asked too many questions, he moved on, because he had a lot of different jobs.
Harry Crawford keeps moving because he has a secret so shocking, he even keeps it from those closest to him, like his new love, 35-year-old Annie Burkett.
Harry Crawford hung around and was part of her life and convinced her to marry him.
Harry becomes stepfather to Annie's son. To the world, they are a typical family. No one ever suspects Harry is not what he seems.
He was a very inventive liar, and finding the actual truth about him was extremely difficult.
What Annie doesn't know is that Harry is living a lie. Every day when Harry returns home from work, his double life stares him in the face. His name isn't Harry Crawford. He isn't a Scotsman. Harry isn't even a man. He's Eugenia Fellini, an Italian woman. It's a secret he'll soon kill to protect. Concealing a dark secret in constant fear of discovery can drive a person to kill. As a married man, Harry Crawford has deceived everyone for decades. He's living a lie. Harry is really Eugenia Fellini, a woman living as a man in a time when transsexuals are not tolerated.
Transsexuals were unheard of. I mean, the term hadn't been invented.
The mores and laws of society were certainly not what they are today. Living as the opposite gender would not have been accepted.
Eugenia can be discovered at any moment and thrown into jail as a deviant.
So what she was doing was actually quite dangerous, because if she'd been discovered, I think there would have been a lot of hostility.
Eugenia has even managed to fool Annie Burkett into marrying. But it's a fraudulent marriage.
The marriage was null and void, and it would have meant that Eugenia had committed some sort of offence by entering into a marriage.
Inconceivably, Annie Burkett has no idea her husband is a woman.
How did she pull that off in the bedroom? Whatever Eugenia had to do to make that work, she did it apparently for quite a while. Lights out, maybe never being seen naked in front of her partner.
He somehow managed to control the situation so that Annie Burkett never found out.
But Eugenia can't conceal her secret forever. After 4 years of marriage, Annie realizes she's been duped. She's devastated.
Annie had suddenly discovered the true gender of her life partner and was threatening to expose Eugenia as a woman.
Harry, being illiterate, being frightened, thought that he would probably be arrested and would have to go to prison.
On September 28, 1917, Eugenia takes drastic action to protect her dark secret. She takes Annie on a picnic in a secluded park.
I think Eugenia's motivation for killing was strictly practical. To save herself, her standing in the community, everyone's belief that she was a man, and to protect her own identity.
Sometime during the afternoon, Eugenia smashes Annie over the head with a bottle.
I think what she did then was panic.
The right blow to the head, at the right place, at the right time, can cause immediate unconsciousness. It is difficult to cause immediate death by blunt force injuries to the head.
Eugenia makes a horrifying miscalculation. Annie isn't dead.
While she was still alive but unconscious, her body was thrown onto a campfire.
Eugenia is trying to get away with murder.
Many people believe, usually wrongly, that they can burn a body either beyond recognition or all evidence can be destroyed, evidence of a crime.
Annie's body is not destroyed. It's found, although not identified. News of the mysterious death hits the papers. Now the biggest threat to Eugenia's secret is her victim's son, who is asking too many questions. In a strange coincidence, his first name is also Harry, Eugenia's male name.
The lies became more and more complicated. With Annie Burkett out of the way, there was only one other obstacle to Harry Crawford remaining Harry Crawford, and that was young Harry Burkett.
Eugenia takes the boy to a notorious suicide spot.
Come on, Harry. Come on and look at the view.
She tries to lure him to the edge. Harry hangs back.
Come on. It's a great view. Come on, Harry. Come on.
It saves his life. Eugenia can't bring herself to wrestle him over the edge.
She had the intention, but she didn't seem to have the will. I think the fear and panic weren't enough to drive her to kill young Harry.
Eugenia's dark secret remains hidden for another 3 years.
Harry Crawford, having murdered Annie Burkett, then went on to marry another woman and was actually married to her for something like 12 months before he, I use the term he loosely, he was arrested by the police and charged with the murder of Annie Burkett.
Police finally caught Eugenia after her victim's body was at last identified. And young Harry's suspicions were confirmed. On July 5th, 1920, Eugenia Fellini is charged with murder.
Of course, Eugenia just became a freak show. There were headlines in the papers, the man-woman monster, pervert, freak, with all sorts of salacious details being hinted at.
Eugenia pleads innocence. But on October 6th, 1920, she's convicted of murder and sentenced to death. But she is spared execution and released after 11 years in prison. Her secret finally revealed, Eugenia would live the rest of her life as a woman. Sometimes the darkest secrets aren't just kept by killers. They are kept by those who should expose them. It's a lesson learned in a Texas hospital where babies were dying without cause.
The other nurses noticed that there were increased numbers of cardiopulmonary arrests on the ward.
Administrators suspect something is seriously wrong.
All her victims were children, you know, the most innocent of the population.
Could it possibly be that a staff member is killing children?
Once it starts, it's very hard to stop.
Someone is keeping a dark secret.
This would not have happened if the cases had been reported to the medical examiner's office.
1981, in Bexar County, Texas. The Medical Center Hospital holds a dark secret. Babies are dying way too frequently.
Say that they expected one a week, but all of a sudden they were getting three or four or five a week.
Administrators suspect they have a murderer loose in the pediatric ICU.
I don't think there was any doubt that they had a good idea of what she was doing.
They even have a prime suspect.
Somebody that has been trained to protect and save lives, not kill people.
Nurse Janine Jones.
I've had several cases that stand out in my mind, but this one is particularly heinous because of death to small children.
This darkest of secrets began because 31-year-old vocational nurse Janine Jones has a secret compulsion, a hero complex. She likes the idea she can save lives in an emergency. She is a super nurse.
When someone has a strong need to be seen as a hero, a savior, we call that a hero complex. When it becomes so deep-seated a need that the individual creates a scenario where they can rush in and save the person, that's when it becomes dangerous.
Janine uses a variety of drugs to stress her young victims, like blood thinners and cardiac arrest agents. She doesn't necessarily want to kill her victims, just make them sick enough to rescue.
That was her way of getting attention. She was a big person.
Code Red! First aid, Code Red!
Okay, just suspend the machine.
She was a big person when she resuscitated children, when she brought them back from death's door. And the rest of her life, she wasn't anything.
Janine chooses victims younger than speaking age, silent witnesses to what she does.
Signs?
There's nothing.
Are you getting
anything? I'm a dentist.
But all too often, they remain silent forever because Janine miscalculates her poison. Criminal profiler Candace DeLong thinks Janine was searching for respect.
Somewhere along the line in her development, probably in adolescence and going into her years as a young woman, Janine realized that she could feel important when she was tending to defenseless people, especially children. It made her feel powerful and giving and that she could be respected by other people for this.
Perhaps Janine is compensating for previous losses. Soon after birth, she was abandoned by her natural parents and handed over for adoption. At 16, her closest brother died in an accident. Another brother succumbed to cancer 8 years later. Cancer also took her father at age 56.
If a child feels unloved, that person as an adult may spend the rest of their life trying to acquire the attention and the love that they didn't get as a child. And engage in various behaviors, sometimes criminal behaviors, to gain the power that they did not have as a child.
Whatever Janine's motivation, her attempts at being a hero turn deadly. In 1 2-week period at the Medical Center Hospital ICU, 7 children die. But her co-workers are starting to connect the dots and ask questions.
They noticed that all of them were on the same shift, and all of them involved patients being taken care of by Janine Jones. And they became very suspicious. They reported it to their senior nursing personnel.
But administrators don't take immediate action. The hospital reports no abnormal deaths to the county medical examiner and doesn't instantly remove Nurse Jones.
She was left on the ward even though they knew what was going on.
Only after agitation from senior doctors do administrators finally do something.
Someone said, well, why don't we just fire her? And then they said, well, she'll sue us and there'll be a big scandal. They were more interested in saving their reputation and not being sued than in the life and health of these children.
Dr. Vincent DeMayo still rages at this case more than 20 years later. He was Bexar County's chief medical examiner when Janine Jones' crimes finally came to light.
I would say that she was the worst serial murderer in the history of this county, and probably in the history of Texas.
Dr. DeMeo finds it hard to choose which is worse, that a nurse could kill sick children, or that her murders were covered up.
We're not sure of exactly how many children she killed because a lot of the records disappeared. There was so much cover-up. The bodies were never autopsied because the cases were never reported to my office.
Eventually, the hospital raises the training bar for ICU nurses. Janine no longer qualifies.
So when they adopted that policy, then they let her go from that unit. Let go, by the way, with an excellent letter of recommendation, even though they knew what was going on.
Incredibly, a killer walks away from the Medical Center Hospital in San Antonio with a reference. Her dark secret is safe. She is free to kill again. The only question is, where? Amongst the darkest secrets in Texas criminal records is the case of Nurse Janine Jones.
They didn't know exactly what it was, but statistically it showed that Janine Jones was responsible for what was going on.
In 1981, Janine is suspected of poisoning innocent children so she could become a hero by saving their lives.
She would create these medical emergencies, and she would know how to handle it, which made her look like a supreme nurse, that she would take care of the emergencies that she created.
But Super Nurse Jones isn't reported to police. Incredibly, she is allowed to walk away. Then she takes another job at a new pediatrics clinic in Kerrville, Texas.
She ended up here in Kerrville after she left San Antonio because of all these unexplained deaths.
District Attorney Ronald L. Sutton would be the one to finally end Janine's killing spree.
All right, Janine Jones absolutely despises me because I brought down her little self constructed empire.
When Janine Jones begins working in a Kerrville clinic, her new boss, Dr. Kathleen Holland, has no idea of Janine's dark secret. As she treats young patient Chelsea Ann McClellan, Chelsea has a cold.
And the protocol in the doctor's office would be the nurse, Janine Jones, would take the baby into a separate room, just she and the baby. And to perform whatever cursory examination, weight and blood pressure, whatever. But during the time that Janine would have these children by herself, all of a sudden they would become like a rag doll. And then she would scream out,
"The baby's not breathing!"
Once again, Nurse Jones is hailed a hero, saving Chelsea from respiratory arrest.
The need to do this is like a bottomless pit. It's never filled.
It kept happening.
Just 1 month later, little Chelsea is again in respiratory arrest after another routine checkup by Nurse Jones. Dr. Holland and Janine race with her by ambulance to the ER. But Chelsea doesn't survive this time. She's dead on arrival.
I think the death of her victims was incidental to all the excitement and the thrill she got from being involved in trying to save a dying child.
The initial autopsy rules sudden infant death syndrome, but closer inspection starts to uncover Janine's secret.
And that's when we talked to the anesthesiologist who said this child looked like he was coming out from the effects of succinylcholine, and we launched our investigation at that point.
Succinylcholine is a paralytic agent, and it blocks the neurological impulse from the nerve to the muscle. It's the blocking of the respiratory effort, so an individual basically asphyxiates to death.
The secret of Janine Jones' hero complex is unraveling. After Chelsea's death, she visits her grave and seems genuinely remorseful.
I think Janine may have been conflicted, but her need to kill was stronger than her need to not. And that was her mistake.
Janine's grief is a shock for Chelsea's mother, who happens to visit at the same time.
Janine, what are you doing here?
Why is a nurse she hardly knows at the gravesite so distraught? Back at the clinic, Dr. Holland discovers more incriminating evidence. Her vial of succinylcholine, a paralyzing agent often called a nectine, has been perforated by a needle.
And there were two holes in the lid of this bottle. One where she had withdrawn a nectine from it and attempted to replace it with saline solution.
The final piece of evidence comes from Chelsea's exhumed body. It reveals traces of a nectine. But as investigators close in, the most telling lead comes from Janine Jones' colleagues at her last nursing job.
And I said, well, what's her name? I said, Janine Jones. And the answer was, oh, yeah, the one who murdered the kids.
Nurse Janine Jones was a suspected killer well before she arrived at the Kerrville Clinic. It is only Chelsea's murder that finally puts her away. For 99 years, convicted of first-degree murder and causing injury to 7 other children. No one has ever been charged over the unexplained deaths at Medical Center Hospital.
This was a devastating case on the community, on the medical profession, on the nursing profession, on the county hospital.
To this day, Janine Jones maintains she is innocent, insisting that she has no dark secret, a common trait of denial from those with a hero complex.
The safest place for them to be for society is to spend the rest of their life incarcerated. There is no way we can ever know that they will not kill again.
The darkest secrets are those designed to conceal murder. Judy Winoano kept her secrets and killed for profit. She cashed in on those who trusted her most. Eugenia Fellini feared a Victorian society's judgment, so she murdered to keep her intimate secret. And Janine Jones, her secret compulsion possibly claimed the lives of 46 infants. What price a secret? For these deadly women, their victims paid the ultimate price. Judy is also a pathological liar.
She fabricated almost everything about herself. She would invent everything from her lineage with her mother to a non-existent Apache tribe to having a PhD in biochemistry. She just couldn't keep a straight story straight for very long.
Judy is a pathological liar.
Pathological lying is characterized by, well, it's basically someone that will lie when the truth would have been easier to tell. And one of the things we see in sociopathic behavior is this chronic lying. It starts as a child.
Judy's childhood was horrible. Her mother died young. Her father and his new wife mistreated her.
Between him and his new wife, her stepmother, she was very, very abused, made to work endless hours, burned with cigarettes, according to her, and led a horrible life. Until at the age of 14, something snapped. She had a major episode of violence, and she was sent to prison for 2 months, for 60 days. At the end of her 60-day sentence, when the judge asked her if she was ready to go home, she basically opted to go to reform school, claiming that the abuse on the home front was so terrible that she would be better off at reform school. And that started her on her downhill slide that lasted the rest of her life.
As a writer and a woman, Suzanne Faulkner is fascinated by the audacity of Eugenia's deception.
She developed a way of walking that she felt was masculine. She copied the way she heard men talk, which involved a lot of swearing.
And for once, fashion is on Eugenia's side.
People just assume when you saw someone dressed as a man with short hair wearing a hat that it was a man.
Historian Nerida Campbell is also fascinated by Australia's most unique murderer.
The women tended to have long hair, the men tended to have short hair. They wore quite different types of clothing, so I think that was how she was able to get away with that.
She was very, very good. She could manipulate people, she could convince them she was someone that she wasn't. And that takes a lot of work.
She was obviously a woman who was under quite a bit of stress. We see her drinking heavily, according to some of the witnesses. Many behaviours that we associated with someone who is highly stressed.
And for Janine, that was the excitement. But as all excitement does, it eventually ends. And everybody goes back to work. And that was a tremendous letdown. I think that's probably when the depression set in for Janine. And the only way to relieve that depression, do it again. Their need to do it increases. They do it more frequently. Anytime anybody does anything more frequently, they get sloppy at it, and that's when they get caught.
Get more deadly women online. www.investigationdiscovery.com. Eugenia Fellini feared a Victorian society's judgment, so she murdered to keep her intimate secret. And Janine Jones, her secret compulsion possibly claimed the lives of 46 infants. What price a secret? For these deadly women, their victims paid the ultimate price.